everybody this morning. I was over at the B3 service a while ago doing the welcome, and it is packed over there. So there's no way we could have got everybody from this service and that service into in one spot. And get some more chairs out. And that's not a problem. That's an opportunity. We're always glad to do that. So I have a friend. He pastors a church in San Antonio, Texas. He tells this story. He had a young lady in his congregation by the name of Jennifer. And Jennifer had a dream. And her dream was to be a nurse. And she had a very tender heart. She had a very good mind. She was very good with her hands. And she had a dream to be a nurse. But she knew if she was going to be a nurse, it was going to almost be a miracle, because to go to college, her family was not going to be able to help her at all financially. Also, if Jennifer was to finish college, she would be the first member of any of her extended family to ever graduate from college. So Jennifer graduates from high school, and she makes great grades. She gets accepted into a nursing program, but she can't go because she doesn't have the money. But she doesn't let that deter her. She begins to work, and she just keeps putting money away from every paycheck to save for college tuition. And just dollar after dollar after dollar, she puts in a box in her bedroom. And she is just determined that she is going to go to college. So she lives at home with her single mom and her brother, who is 14 years old, and she does that so she can save more money. And in the meantime, her brother, who is 14, begins to have some brushes with the law. He begins to get in trouble at school, and it's no secret that he's developing a drug habit. But she defends him. She encourages her brother. People that are judgmental of her brother, she sticks up for him with just this fierce loyalty. And she tells people, God's going to use my brother one of these days. In the meantime, she just keeps putting money into her box. One day, Jennifer comes home to put some more money in her box in her bedroom. And she opens it up. And all the money's gone, except for one $20 bill. She is devastated when she finds out her 14-year-old brother took it to pay for his drug habit. You know, betrayal is difficult. And betrayal can wound and hurt deeply. And it's bad enough when it's a coworker or some other type of relationship, maybe a friend. But when it comes from a family member, it can be absolutely devastating. Ask Joseph, the guy that we're going to look at this morning in Genesis chapter 37. You know, we've been doing this series called The Story. And what we've been doing is we've been trying to put all the pieces together of God's story and then look at how our story fits in to God's story. By the way, if you're wondering about Jennifer, we'll talk more about her later. So don't think I just left you hanging. But we're trying to figure out how our story fits in to God's story. And so today we're going to kind of land on this guy, Joseph. And Joseph, like our character Abraham, takes up a large part of the real estate of the book of Genesis. His story starts in Genesis chapter 37 and then runs on out through the rest of the book. And what we see in the story of Joseph, that it kind of starts with a dream and then some betrayal and then just a whole lot of disappointment in life. How many of y'all remember the children's series of books called Choose Your Own Adventure? How many of y'all remember that? Just stick your hand up. Okay, I see a bunch of hands down here, a few hands back there. Well, you know, the unique thing about the Choose Your Own Adventure series, and it actually sold 250 million copies, is that you got to choose how the book ended. And some of the books would have, like, I believe I read as many as 26 different endings. So like you're reading and you've got your hero and you got the plot and all that, and let's say you got to page 72. And then you got to decide what happened from there. You might could go to page 93 and read one ending, or you might could go to a page 112 and read a different ending, but you got to choose how it ended. And it had to be very popular to sell 250 million copies. But here's a question for you. Why do you think it is as popular as that children's series was, there was never a corresponding adult series? Here's why I think. It's because as adults, we realize that most of the time in life, you don't get to choose the ending. You don't get to choose how things turn out. Now, when we're young, when we're children, when we're teenagers, when we're young adults, we have these dreams and we're full of idealism and we think we know how things are going to work and how the plan's going to go and how our story's going to go. But as you age, now tell me, am I not right? A lot of times it doesn't go how you're anticipating. Sometimes it's good. I mean, I never dreamed. I'm a West Texas boy. I grew up pastoring a church in Georgia. But a lot of times it doesn't turn out good. Things that we didn't anticipate happen. And there can be a lot of disappointment in life. And that's exactly what happens here with Joseph. Joseph is the son of Jacob. He's the great-grandson of Abraham, who we studied last week. As we pick up the story here in Genesis chapter 37, Joseph is a teenager. Most people think that he's probably about 17 years old. And he's growing up in this just really dysfunctional home. And when I say it's dysfunctional, as we're going to look at this morning, I think that's probably an understatement. And we find as we begin that he is his father's favorite son. He's got 10 brothers, and most of them are from, or all of them except for his brother Benjamin, are from other moms, and just himself is the daughter of Rachel, who is his dad's, Jacob's, favorite wife. And so Joseph kind of becomes Jacob's favorite son. And one of the things that Jacob does is he gives Joseph this coat. You probably remember this from Sunday school. This coat that we refer to oftentimes is a coat of many colors. And so he gives him this coat, and it's just not a coat. There's symbolism here. This coat signifies to his other brothers that he's my favorite. Out of all of you, he's my favorite. And it also kind of says to the other brothers, and most of my inheritance, it's going to Joseph. And also, guys, because of this coat, I mean, it's like a suit, what we call like a suit coat. He's telling the other boys, hey, he's not going to be working out in the fields with you guys. He's not going to be doing that manual labor kind of stuff. You know, he's my favorite, and it's going to be different for them. So he gives his coat to his son. And I'm going to ask my two children to come up here this morning because I want to kind of paint a picture of the significance of this coat. They have no idea about this. So come on up here, Haley, and these are my two youngest. And today is Sean's 16th birthday. So it's his birthday, and I thought I'd get him a gift. And it's not her birthday, but I thought, just to be fair, I'd give her a gift too. So I got both of y'all a gift. You can hold on to that. Don't open it yet. Ladies first. So Haley, I'm going to let you open that up. $100 bill. It's your birthday. She got a $100 bill. Show everybody so they can see it. What is it? It's a rubber ball. So how do you feel? She got a $100 bill and you you got a bouncy ball and it's your birthday. Betrayed. Yeah, I'd say so. And I'll let y'all go ahead and say that. I keep it. It's yours. You get to keep the bouncy ball. And Shaw, you know there'll be other gifts later today. But that's exactly what Jacob did. It's like he gave one kid a bouncy ball, and he gave the other, all the other brothers got bouncy balls, and Joseph got a $100 bill. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, you can just imagine. I mean, Sean said he felt betrayed, but he knows this is all a good fun. But what if it was real? Can you imagine what's going to happen in that family and the dysfunction and the anger and the frustration that's going to be there? And that's exactly what happens in this family because of the favoritism that the dad gives to one son. So we read in Genesis chapter 37, verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, notice that next phrase, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So you see those two phrases? They hated him. I mean, the thing had gotten so bad that they hated their brother and they couldn't even speak a kind word to them. Some of you have been there. You realized real fast that you couldn't choose your own adventure because you didn't get to choose your own family. And you grew up in one of those families like Joseph's that was dysfunctional. And there weren't kind words. There were harsh words. And there was negativity. And there was hatred. And it just sucked the life out of you early on. That's exactly kind of what happens in these kind of situations. So Joseph is growing up. I mean, it's like a reality TV show here. He's growing up in a house with three stepmoms. Can you imagine three stepmoms all in the same house? I mean, can you imagine the catfighting is going on? And all these different kids that are there, stepbrothers and stepsisters and that kind of thing. And then listen, Joseph doesn't help anything. He has a dream. And in this dream, all of his brothers bow down to him. Now, let me tell you, some of you siblings here, if you're the youngest in your family or you're not the oldest, and you have a dream where your brothers and sisters are going to bow down to you, keep said dream to yourself. Because it's probably not going to go over very good. Don't rush to breakfast and over a bowl of Cheerios, tell your brothers and sisters about the dream that they're going to be bowing down to you. But that's exactly what Joseph does. He tells his brothers and that they're going to be bowing down to him. Bad move. And I mean, that just makes the hatred even worse. And things are just going downhill in a hurry. So one day, Joseph sends Jacob out to his brothers who are out in the field. And you know, they're tired and they're hungry and they're sweaty. And here comes Joseph in his coat and tie. Hey, guys, guess what? Can you just see that? And he just kind of comes strolling out there, and they see him coming. And this is what it says in verse 19. Here comes that dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. I mean, did you see where this is gone? This dysfunctional family is so bad that now they're talking about killing their brother? Notice verse 26. One of the older brothers, Judah, who is the stepbrother of Joseph, he says this. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." So now they're kind of rethinking the plan a little bit. Wait a minute. Let's not kill him. Maybe we can get some money out of this. And they sell him, Scripture tells us, for 20 shekels of silver. I did a little bit of research. In today's money, they sold Joseph for about 100 bucks. Now, it's never right to sell somebody. I'm not saying it is. But things were, for $100, they sold their brother. So they sell him into slavery, and at the age of 17, he finds himself a slave in Egypt. And we're told in the scriptures that he was sold to a man by the name of Potiphar, who is captain of the bodyguard of Pharaoh. And so 17 years old, he's a slave, he's working for this guy Potiphar, and Potiphar begins to see some things in Joseph. And he begins to see some administrative abilities in Joseph. And he begins to see some leadership skills in Joseph. So he sees these kind of things, and in no time at all, he goes up to this slave, Joseph, and he says, "Hey, I'm going to put you in charge of everything." And it's like he just kind of hands him the keys to the house, so to speak, and his affairs. He says, "Hey, I want you to take care of everything. I'm riding off into retirement or whatever, play golf every afternoon. You're going to be in charge." So Joseph's still a slave, but he's kind of worked himself up into this pretty good gig. Remember I said earlier this was kind of like a reality show? Well, now it kind of takes this turn like Desperate Housewives. I mean, I've never seen it, but I've seen little clips of, you know, the trailers and that kind of stuff. That's kind of what happens now. We're introduced to Potiphar's wife. And most likely, because of Potiphar's position, she would have been a very beautiful lady. Many guys, scholars say she was probably like a trophy wife. And she just kind of physically wants Joseph. I mean, just for her own physical desires, and she starts making passes at Joseph. And at one point she says to Joseph, "Come to bed with me." And that's kind of the PG translation. If you were to translate it out of the original Hebrew, it wouldn't even be PG-13. I mean, it was just so crass. But she's making these passes at Joseph. And listen to how Joseph responds in verse 9 of chapter 39. "How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Verse 10, "Though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her." So here's what we see for Joseph. A lot of disappointment. Like any teenage boy, he had dreams. He thought things were going to happen. He had that dream of his brothers bowing down. And he's disappointed. Just like a lot of us are disappointed in life sometimes. But in the midst of his disappointment, please understand this, he is faithful. Contrast how Joseph reacts to how a lot of us react to disappointment. Joseph stays faithful. A lot of times when we're disappointed with God, what do? We disobey. And we use our disappointment as a rationale for disobeying God. And we do something like this. "You know, God, I thought I was doing the right thing. And I was doing what you were asking me to do. And then things aren't working out. So I'm just going to live my way." Am I right? Is that not the game that we play sometimes with God? And we use our disappointment to justify our disobedience. And in this context here, it has to do with sexual sin. And I think certainly a lot of times in the area of sexual temptation and sexual sin, we use the disappointment that we have and justify our disobedience. There was a recent survey done of Christian singles, and they said, "What's the number one temptation that you face?" And the results of that survey were 90% of single Christians said that their biggest temptation was sexual sin. And then somebody made the comment, "Well, I know what the other 10% struggle with." And somebody said, "What?" They said, "Lying." So you kind of get the point here. A lot of singles, you're in a position and you're living a certain way and you're living pure and you think by now God would have sent somebody your way, and it hasn't happened. And so you justify and you say, "You know what? I'm just going to live life my way because God's way doesn't seem to be working." And it's not just singles. Married people do that kind of thing too. You know, married people get disappointed sometimes. And, you know, probably the only thing worse than being single is being married and wishing you were single. You know what I'm saying? And so what happens in marriages sometimes, a wife, you know, her husband doesn't pour into her, emotionally her tank is empty, she can't remember the last time she was honored and felt loved and listened to, and justifies, well, okay, I'm going to flirt at the office, or I'm going to go on social media and chat with an old boyfriend or something like that, and men, you know, my wife's not meeting my needs of intimacy, and, you know, intimacy on my wife's list is like somewhere between doing the dishes and folding the laundry, and, you know, I've got needs, and so they go online and fill those needs that kind of way. And we justify our disobedience because of our disappointment. Listen, Joseph's story is not turning out how he thought it would. And his life is not unfolding how he thought it would. But he's faithful to God. So Joseph says, what we read a while ago to Potiphar's wife, how could I do such a thing and sin against God? How could God do such a thing to Joseph, we could ask? He's sold into slavery. All these things are happening to him, and they're not his fault. He's a slave. He's never going to get married. There's all kinds of disappointment here. But here's what Joseph does. He stays faithful in the midst of his disappointment. One day, Potiphar's wife takes this to a whole nother level. And she grabs Joseph by the coat. And Joseph wiggles out of the coat and he flees. And she screams, rape. And so the security guards, they take Joseph into custody and they throw Joseph into prison. And if there's one thing worse than being a slave, it's being a prisoner. And here's something that's really interesting. I just came across this week, and like you, I've probably heard this story who knows how many times. But the word captain of the bodyguard actually means, the word bodyguard here means executioner. And so Potiphar is the chief executioner for Pharaoh. And in Egyptian times, the common way to execute somebody would be to bury them alive. And this is just kind of a little bit of speculation, but it's really interesting. So what this particular author was saying was, it's interesting to note that he doesn't execute Joseph. Why would he not execute Joseph? Because the offense that he committed was an offense he could be killed for. Well, the kind of speculation here was that he actually believed that Joseph probably didn't do it. That he probably trusted Joseph more than he trusted his wife. And so he didn't kill Joseph because he really didn't think Joseph did it, but he couldn't take a side against his wife being in his particular position, and so the next best thing was to keep Joseph alive but put him into prison. So he saves face with his wife and the security people, and at the same time, he spares Joseph's life. Interesting. I'd never read that before. So Joseph is in prison. When I say prison, probably more like, in our minds, think dungeon. And he's probably just chained to a hole in the floor. Now think about this. None of this is his fault. Joseph didn't sin. It wasn't his sin. It wasn't his disobedience. It wasn't his rebellion. It wasn't his unfaithfulness. It wasn't his fault. It's just life. And he was a victim of somebody else's choices and somebody else's decisions. And maybe you've been there. And life isn't turning out the way you thought it would, and it's not your fault. Somebody else's choices and somebody else's decisions. So here's the question that we ask at this point in the story. Where is God in this disappointment? 13 years have passed since he was sold into slavery. Where's God in all this? Where's God in the midst of our and your disappointment? Some of you are in a season of your life right now, and you might be asking that question. To Jack, who's on his third round of chemo after his wife passed away of cancer last year. And Jackie, who's pregnant with her first child, but her husband has left her for another woman. Where's God in the midst of those two examples? Or what about Heather, who was abused as a child and now she struggles with cutting and having any type of relationships? How about Jane, who's kind of tethered to the house because her daughter was hit by a drunk driver and paralyzed from the waist down? Where's God in the middle of all that? In the midst of the disappointment, or maybe a better word would be devastation, or where's God if we're in the dungeon? God points out a couple things to us that I think kind of answer that question in Joseph's life and in our life too, in Genesis chapter 39. In verse 2, Joseph is still a slave, and it says this, five words, "The Lord was with Joseph." You go on down into the chapter, and he's a prisoner at that point. Same five words, verse 23. God, the Lord, was with Joseph. It doesn't seem like it, but God was there. So we continue the story. God is with him. And the warden of the prison sees some very similar things that Potiphar saw. He sees those administrative abilities and those managerial skills. And so he takes Joseph and he begins to put him in charge of some of the prisoners. And there's two particular prisoners that are brought to our attention that Joseph is in charge of. One of them is a cupbearer. And what is a cupbearer? If you go on monsterjobs.com, you're probably not going to find any classified ads for cupbearers. A cupbearer was the guy that would drink or taste the wine before it was given to Pharaoh to make sure that Pharaoh would be poisoned. So you got a cupbearer and you have a baker. And so these two guys have dreams and they realize that there's something significant about their dreams. And so they ask Joseph, or Joseph finds out about their dreams, and he interprets their dreams and they come to pass exactly as Joseph said they would. And so these dreams are interpreted, and eventually the cupbearer gets out of prison. And he gets out of prison, and he goes back to his job with Pharaoh. And one night, Pharaoh has a dream. And Pharaoh wakes up the next morning, and he's really bothered by this dream. And he knows there's something really significant about this dream. So he asks his wise men, and he seeks counsel from his advisors. And nobody can tell him what the dream means. But he knows there's something about it. And the cupbearer, he overhears this dream, and he comes to Pharaoh and he says, "Hey, look, when I was in prison, there was this guy." This guy is our guy, Joseph. He said, "There was this guy, and he interpreted my dream." So Pharaoh asked for Joseph to be brought in. So get this. Joseph, a prisoner, which was way worse than being a prisoner in our system, is standing before Pharaoh, who is probably the most powerful person in the world, to interpret his dream. And here's what Pharaoh says after Joseph interprets his dream. Chapter 41, verse 38. Pharaoh knows this is from God. He says this, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all of this known to you, there's no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." And then the last verse, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." What? The slave turned prisoner is now going to be like deputy Pharaoh? He's going to be like vice president of the entire land? How does this happen? You know how it happens. Because God is writing the story. God is writing the story. Remember what we talked about last week? God needed to build a great nation. So who did he get? He didn't get the CrossFit couple, the young couple. He got Abraham and Sarah, who were infertile, you know, like the elderly, unwalker couple. That's who he chose. Because Because like we talked about last week, he uses the least likely people to accomplish his purpose and to tell his story. And so now the time has come and he needs somebody powerful in place because his famine's coming. And he needs somebody in charge to save his people. Who does he choose? An ex-con, an ex-slave, a really young guy, 30 years old. That's who he uses. Probably not the person that we're going to pick if we're looking at the resumes. So God uses Joseph to execute his plan, and there's a 7-year famine that comes to Egypt. And eventually that famine spreads out everywhere. And it eventually makes it to Joseph's hometown of Canaan. And his father's still alive. Of course, he has no idea that Joseph's alive, because his brothers faked Joseph's death and had that cover-up where they dipped Joseph's coat in blood of a goat and told their father that he had been killed by wild animals. So he thinks Joseph's dead. I mean, he was devastated at that. His brothers probably think he died a long time ago. You know, you send somebody into slavery, they're probably not going to live that long back then. So Jacob has no idea of any of the Joseph's alive, let alone being in charge of anything. But he sends his sons because he's heard that there is food in Egypt. And he's heard that there is grain. And they have money, but they don't have any food. So his brothers go. And 22 years have passed since they have seen his brother. You know, when you're a teenager, there's all kinds of changes that take place. I mean, you can see, I've seen kids that are 13, and by 17, I could hardly recognize them. Well, they hadn't seen Joseph. Last time they saw him, he was a teenager. He was 17, and now he's 39. So they don't recognize him. And they come before Joseph, and you know what they do? They bow down. You remember that? Like God said it would be? Have no idea who it is, but they're bowing down in front of the deputy Pharaoh. And so Joseph gives them a few tests to make sure they've changed, and he senses the compassion that they now have for his father, and they just can't stand it any longer. He's got to tell them who he is. And so we pick up the story in Genesis chapter 45, beginning with verse 1, and it says this: "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, 'Have everyone leave my presence!' So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard him. Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still living?' But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified of his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come close to me.' When they had done so, he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you.'" You know what he's saying? Your plan was part of God's story. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Over in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, it says this: "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." The brothers didn't know at the time what they were doing. And God didn't cause the brothers to hate Joseph. And God didn't cause the brothers to sell Joseph into slavery. And God didn't cause Potiphar's wife to falsely accuse him and scream rape. But you know what God did? He took all of that, and he turned it into good. And he took all of that, and he used it for his glory. That's what God does. He can take all those decisions, and he can take all those choices, and he can take all those broken pieces, and he can take all that disappointment. You know what he says? "I can work with that. I can work with that." And he accomplishes his purpose, and he accomplishes his glory. And that's kind of a view of God's sovereignty. He can take anything, and he can use it for his glory. Here's what I want to say to you today: never give up. Never give up. God can use your story. never too broken. It's never too late. You're never too old. It's never too busted. God can take the pieces and he can use your story. Remember our story of Jennifer? As Paul Harvey used to say, let me tell you the rest of the story. So my pastor friend out there in San Antonio, a couple weeks later, he doesn't know any of this that has happened in Jennifer's life. He preaches a sermon on forgiveness. And Jennifer's heart's touched because she's having a tough time with her brother and betrayal and disappointment and those kind of things. And during that service, she forgave her brother. And she wanted to just kind of be encouraging to my friend. And so she wrote a note about what she had done during that service, about the circumstances with her brother and how she had just forgiven him. And she took that note, and she took that last $20 bill, which was all that had been left in the box. She put the $20 bill, wrapped it up in that piece of paper, and dropped it in the offering plate. And she just signed it, Jennifer. No last name. That note makes its way to the desk of my friend on Monday morning. He has no idea who Jennifer is. It's a church of thousands. So all week, he's asking people and he's trying to learn her identity. Nobody knows. So the next Sunday morning in the early service that they had, he read, changed the names, and read the story that I shared with you earlier. After the service, a couple came up to him crying. They said, "We want to pay for Jennifer's tuition." Two other families came up and said, "We want to pay for Jennifer's tuition." Not just 1 year, but all 4 years. So they get to their next service. He reads the story again. And this time at the end, he says, "If you are the person that wrote this story, would you please come and talk to me after the service?" So the story ends, and he's up front talking to different people, and this young lady timidly approaches him, and it's Jennifer. And he shares with Jennifer what these three families want to do for her. And she sheds tears of disbelief and tears of joy. And Jennifer went on and graduated from nursing school with honors, became an oncology nurse. She's also a loving mom and a wonderful wife. And today she helps people with that wonderful skill set that she has and that compassion and that tenderness that she has. And many people respond to her gifts. Her lower story was all about betrayal and disappointment and unforgiveness. But the upper story, God had a plan. God was going to make sure that she went to school and be able to fulfill that dream. And it was only after she came to a place of forgiveness and a place of trust in God that she was able to see that upper story. I want to share with you this morning by video a family in our church that knows a lot about disappointment. And a lot about a lower story and an upper story. So if you would, run that video for me.
Hi, my name is Joey.
My name is Jana.
We are the Cope family, and this is our story.
So Joey and I met at College, Tennessee Temple. We've been married for 6 years. It'll be 7 in June.
Just to start off at a young age, not even 2, I was 18 months old. I was diagnosed with leukemia and went through 2.5 years of chemotherapy. So in 2013, we'd been married a couple of years. We decided, you know, to start talking about having kids and stuff. And I've always had this desire to foster, adopt, to get kids from a bad situation and be able to help them out if at all possible. But Jana at first was not really on the same page, and kind of remember how you kind of came along with it.
Selfishly, I never considered adopting or fostering. I just wanted to have my kids. That's what I've grown up believing, I would have my own kids. So fostering and adopting was never in the picture for me to begin with.
Yeah, so one night, Jana kind of surprised me. She comes home from a Shauna Pearce concert, of all things, and tells me about one of the speakers that was there, and kind of the way he presented it to the audience just kind of encouraged her to kind of want to do that before we had our own kids. We knew the chances of having kids with the chemotherapy that I'd taken. The doctors have already told us it would be kind of slim to none, not impossible, but a very, very slim chance. So that was very just kind of, discouraging. It was just not a good time. And then I guess over the last few years here, we've been able to get pregnant, but not a successful pregnancy.
In 2015, we had just received our second foster placement that January. And in March, we find out we're pregnant. Super excited. Tell our family, in our first trimester. And then I do go in for the ultrasound, thinking, nothing's wrong, and find out there's not a heartbeat. So we did experience our first miscarriage that year. And then just this past December, find out we're pregnant again, and shortly after lose the second baby. With the history of our chances of pregnancy being slim and then getting pregnant twice, the questions of why are huge for us, and why are we pregnant and losing these children? I don't know that we've found the answer for that, per se, specifically, but really it's a matter of our faith in God and knowing that the upper story is the best story, not the lower story of what we can see here.
I don't think I knew what it really meant for somebody to feel that loss until I went there myself. So, is that why God had it happen to us? I don't know that. But now, when somebody talks to me about them having a miscarriage or going through that, man, I can hurt with them so much more. I guess for a man and your wife going through this and not being able to help her out or do anything about it was very tough. It gives me almost an empty feeling inside, and kind of trying to figure out where God is all in all this. Even somebody who's been a minister of the gospel now for 12 years, and just wondering what did we do wrong, what's going on, was really disheartening. But knowing that there's a bigger picture here, and we begin to foster even, and having kids come into our home, and for 8 months at a time, and really get this connection with them, and then them be taken back, was really tough. But then in January of 2015, got a little girl into our home, not even 2 years old, coming to our home, and supposed to be temporary. Supposed to be just a situation where she's gonna just be here for maybe a few months, and now she's been in our house for 3 years. And we were able to adopt her and her little sister and see this great bigger picture in this upper story where God had this all worked out, and kind of through our pain and stuff that we didn't really understand what God was doing, that we would be able to bless these two little sweet girls through all this situation that we may have not done if we would have had kids of our own, and just seeing how God works all this out together.
So we have adopted Mikaylin, who is 4. Her birthday's coming up in March, so she's excited. And then we also have London, her sister, who she just turned 2 in January. And we are currently fostering their younger brother, Neelan, who will be 1 February 18th. So to all you ladies out there who, you may have a similar story to mine, what I really would hope to encourage you is what I've learned through both miscarriages and the loss of some foster kids that we loved as our own. It's just to realize that we have a Heavenly Father who loves us, and He has the best plan for us, and our job is to trust that and to lean on Him in those times. And I can truly say that at my lowest point, that is when I grew the most and I learned to love Him and trust His plan the most.
Story. And I don't know what your disappointments in life may be. It may have words like miscarriage, infertility, betrayal, divorce, abuse, terminal, cancer, disease, unemployed. But I know this. There's a lower story. We have to rise above that lower story in our circumstances, and I love the way Joey put it, and see the big picture. And of course, we talk about the big picture. We're talking about the upper story. And realize that when you experience disappointment, those tough kinds of things come, and those kind of words describe your disappointment. We realize that God has not abandoned us. And we look beyond our lower story and realize that there's a bigger story. Can I pray for us, please?